Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. This is where Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi bring you the latest news and information on pro wrestling and MMA, as well as interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap with your hosts, Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Ringside Wrap. Rich Tate here with you, as well as Les Thatcher and Mike Sempervivi. Les, Mike, how you guys doing this week?
I'm doing not too bad for an old guy. How about you, Michael?
I'm not doing too bad for a little bit less than middle-aged guy.
And you, Rich Tate, and how are you?
I'm doing better than last week.
Thank God.
Yeah. And hey, the National League finally gets home field advantage for the World Series again, just in time for the Braves to return to the postseason. So, yeah.
Yes. And LeBron has left the building.
Yeah. Oh God. Did anybody watch that garbage?
I didn't watch it. You know, the only thing about it, I mean, you know, it's free world. He can do what he wants to do. The only thing I see is, if Miami does not win a title next year, the sports media will eat those kids alive.
Oh, yeah.
God, absolutely. We actually had it on at work because it became such a running joke for people that were coming in. And it just became a big joke. And it just, you know, ESPN is ESPN. They were the entertainment and sports channel. That's what they've always said that they are. Why it's ESPN, but I'm glad the Boys and Girls Club made $5 million, but oh my God, it was insufferable.
Yeah, it's it's showbiz, right? that's for
well,
sure.
Well, and then of course Dan Gilbert, you know, I mean, who doesn't love an owner that goes absolutely apeshit?
That was crazy.
And post a letter like that on their website. You gotta love it.
That was just crazy. You know,
that's the letter you write to your girlfriend when you break up, and then, you know, you think about it for a second, you know, put it back in the drawer or throw it away or something like that. That was a little emotional.
Well, you know, I honestly believe after the 7 years, you know, it would have been polite, I guess, professional to have let, you know, hey, tell this guy, you know, just even if it's not just before you go on the air, you telephone him and say, look, I made my decision, and here's what I'm going to do, and I appreciate, you know, the 7 years. You know, and then if he goes off, then he goes off. But I understand, you know, it's like you're divorcing your wife on television before you tell her, right? 18 million other people find out at the same time. I thought that was a little, you know, otherwise it was if you watch the clips of those three guys being introduced in Miami, it was more like a rock show, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, and just as Dan Gilbert comes out as the freak owner of the year, you know, George Steinbrenner obviously passing away yesterday. I don't care if you were a baseball fan or not. You knew who George Steinbrenner was, and that's just a huge loss to the city of New York, I imagine. And you know, just baseball in general.
Yeah, well, there's the guy that opened the door for the huge salaries.
Oh yeah.
You know. Yeah. And he brought New York, you know, he bought New York, brought New York, whatever the case may be, a lot of titles. But then there were some dry years that the money was spent, too. You know, I think that's the thing, too. The fact that you lump a bunch of superstars together doesn't necessarily guarantee anything. You know,
no, Dave Winfield was supposed to be the next Reggie Jackson when he signed him away from Toronto. I mean, those 80s years, a lot of people don't remember those years were because they think of Don Mattingly and they think of some of the guys that were on that team, but those were bad teams. Rod Guidry was about the only thing they had. I mean, they had some very lean years there, but you know what I feel bad for in all this, too, is that a lot of Tampa wrestling people, or not even Tampa wrestling people, but wrestling people all over the place because, you know, there's nothing that people probably will forget about is Steinbrenner being such a big wrestling fan, or at least a big WWF fan, that is, mostly.
Sure. And you know, obviously, you can put a lot of big money guys together, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's really all about chemistry and how well.
It's got to be. I mean, it's everything. Your you know, the chemistry with the players, the coaches, the the players amongst themselves. You know, it all comes into play.
And, of course, always a little luck involved as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, here again, wrestling may be what it is, but the point is you go out in front of a bunch of people with a task to perform, and, you know, the pressure is on. It's not a case of whether you have a passion for it or you don't, or you're doing it for the money, whatever. The pressure's still the same, you know, to step up and do what's expected of you and do it on a nightly basis, you know. And basketball's, boys, that's 82 games. You know, it's a long run. It really is, and a lot of things can happen. Well, you can't account for injuries or never mind the three of them. You know, if the nucleus of the others, say the other top three guys get hurt, that's going to cost them something too.
Absolutely.
It takes five to win a game.
God, these three remind me of too, because a lot of the talk has been about how much, you know, collusion has gone on. I guess not collusion when it comes between players. I mean, you know, players have talked about owners doing this for years and years. You know, T.O. is, I'm sure, seething and probably hinting at it right now, if nothing else, when it comes to the NFL. But it's like Ivan Koloff, Ernie Ladd, and Superstar Graham. You know, it's amazing the kind of power the NBA has been in a lot of ways, and for good and for bad. It really is a players' league with the amount of money that's guaranteed and their ability to basically do things like this, I mean, with the success of Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, and Ray Allen in Boston.
Right, right. Well, yeah, it's, you know, the money is ridiculous. I mean, well, I shouldn't say it's ridiculous. I'd take it if they offered it too. But...
Oh, it's disgusting, but it would be lovely.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, but then at some point you think, how much money do you need? I was naive enough to hope that, and again, you know, it's not, I'm not a fanatic about it, but I was a LeBron fan, you know, with the whole being an Ohio boy and everything, and I thought, okay, you know, he does have businesses, you know, in the area there. He's given back to the high school where he went. He goes back there with some regularity. I mean, you know, the guy was kind of bonded with the community and had grown up there, born and raised there. So I was just naive enough to think, well, you know, maybe you'll stay. I mean, how much money do you need? You know, and the competitive thing, I guess, comes into it as well. He wants to win. But, you know, that's the thing. You look back at some of the great basketball players. Bill Russell's got more rings than he's got fingers. But, you know, Oscar Robertson's got one ring. You know, and you've got to admit, he was one of the greatest of all time.
Oh,
you know?
Sure.
And it's just more in recent years that they started judging talent on the number of rings, which really doesn't matter, honestly, you know.
Well, Les, let me ask you a question. And obviously, you know, it's not a sports show, but, you know, good conversation going on here. So I'll just ask one more question about this. You're a huge Celtics fan. Me being from Atlanta and basically, you know, we got a team in all major sports, I don't even know what it's like to not have, other than, you know, for a period there without hockey. What is it, Cincinnati? I mean, who basically, say the local papers there, NBA, do they cover a team? Is it Cleveland? Is it Detroit?
Cleveland probably, yeah, Cleveland more or less, but we get national basketball coverage, not necessarily, you know, focusing in on anything, but I mean, obviously, with, you know, in recent times, LeBron being from Ohio, well, you know, when he was in high school, he was getting press, for God's sakes, you know. But, we had the Cincinnati Royals, which turned into the Kansas City Royals, which turned into the Sacramento, you know, and on and on and on.
Right.
But, you know, at one time here, we had on the team Jerry Lucas, Oscar Robertson, Adrian Smith from the University of Dayton, and they couldn't maintain, you know, didn't draw strong. Of course,
right.
you were in the Eastern Division at the time. There were only two, and the Celtics ruled the roost. But still, you know, you think with that kind of local flavor, Oscar, an All-American from University of Cincinnati, and Lucas, an All-American, well, from Middletown, just 20 miles up the road, and, you know, All-American at Ohio State. But they, you know, and they, you know, they didn't always play second, which you might have thought, you know, in that situation. So, yeah, it's, you know, you can put a lot of superstars in one place. It doesn't necessarily score big, You know, so it'll be interesting. That's for sure. It will be interesting.
So what's the big story of the week? The fact that Paul Heyman's still not at TNA, or is that even a story anymore?
Well, I don't know if it's a story. I know that there's been conversation, but I think he will stand firm with, we've talked about this, the whole political minefield front office and the whole overseeing the thing. I can't imagine anybody in their right mind going in there without the control, because you just beat your head against the wall. You have too many, hurdles to overcome, and or people that can veto you and one thing and another. So I see his point completely. And it would be tremendously interesting to see, how that would play out too. Now, I can tell you that as far as I'm relatively sure, that has absolutely nothing to do with this ECW homecoming or, revival thing they're going to do on the next pay-per-view.
Yeah, and good to see somebody pay homage and bring back ECW, since nobody's done that before.
Here's the thing. I'm sure it'll do a better buy rate probably than have done in recent times. But the negative of it is, of course, some of the regulars TNA roster are going to have a night off. They won't be able to do that pay-per-view, but I think no correlation here with Heyman. As far as I know, Dreamer is the producer of this whole thing. He's it was his idea, and he's kind of the orchestrating of the whole thing, from what I understand. It'll be different. It'll be interesting. But I don't think it's a revival, or that they're going in that direction, or. And I think Heyman is smart enough and creative enough that he wouldn't go in that same direction. He wouldn't try to rewrite it again either, I mean, I think he would obviously would go in another direction than WWE, which is partly, a major part of the whole keys of their success anyway, which hasn't been done. But I do believe that this will be entertaining, But a lot of it is, we're bringing back guys who have been working regular and so forth. So it's more a nostalgia thing. It's been done. I'll tell you what I think is, if they're planning on doing a faction, in which from the beatdown that I understand, it kind of looks like. I think when you do something second, I don't care how well you do it, and these guys in TNA, the old ECW crew, are a lot smarter, a lot more ring-wise veterans than the kids that are doing the Nexus thing, but yet by doing it second, it looks like you're copying WWE.
Especially when there's a big segment of the American wrestling population that watches Lucha Libre, and they're seeing AAA or CMLL do that, right now as well. It was amazing to hear Paul Heyman talk to Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer after the UFC show, and talk about seemingly how far he was away with agreeing to do anything with them, including, flat out saying, no, I'm not going to be a Victory Road. But then looking at it from TNA's point of view, when they seemingly have this thing together, and Jeff Jarrett apparently, Meltzer wrote about it, hinted at it, about it being, they felt as though something could be imminent. It's kind of surprising they did this, although I guess if it's good, it's good in a way if they were leading up to Hulk Hogan and Abyss, that this is just something else that's thrown in the middle of that, since they're obviously not going to get to that with Hulk Hogan having back surgery again.
Yeah, well, and there's talk that that Bischoff wasn't there due to whatever. It was supposed to be other commitments, but there's talk that it was because he wasn't happy with it. Well, obviously the direction has changed too from when those guys came in, and it's just as obvious, to a blind person that what they wanted to work wouldn't and didn't, and they've gone, they've mellowed things down. They've gone to giving you a little more in-ring product opposed to all the nonsense. But I think that indicates that they're trying to do something, But again, I think it's going to take an entire revamping, and that's going to cause some of the guys that have been there forever and have busted their asses is going to cost them, because it's sad, but it can't be unless you have big pockets and like farm system or something like that. You can't keep everybody around, you know. No matter how hard somebody works, everybody's shelf life is different, you know, and some shorter than others, and some have already played out there anyway, I think.
Well, hypothetically, even if Heyman were to start, let's say, tomorrow, knowing what you know about what it takes to run a wrestling promotion and knowing how to do TV and, you know, just to be on a grander scale, realistically, how long do you think it would take him to turn it around? Obviously, there would probably be some improvement right away, but, like, I mean, are we talking, like,
at the shortest?
Do you really think it would be that short? Or is it at the shortest?
At the shortest. You know,
yeah.
Here's the thing. I think your key physical talents there right now have been diluted just by the here's the thing. I would never shortchange Angle on his in-ring work ethic or his talent in any way, shape, or form. But you turn a guy babyface heel, babyface heel, babyface heel. You know, he's feuding with his wife, and he's in a feud with her, you know, and on and on and on. Each time it takes a little chink out of their power to draw. The same with Abyss, you know, that whole thing, or anybody. Styles been back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. All these guys are tremendous performers, but you still take a little bit away from them in terms of potential value for pay-per-views or house shows or anything else, you know, because you're wearing that whole thing thin. You've heard me say it a million times. Virtually everything in the business now that's worth doing has been overdone. And backing off is going to be probably more important. But, yeah, I think – and again, it depends, Mike, on the talent and how they gel. You can sit down and have the greatest storyline, greatest angles worked out in the world, but if you don't put the proper people in those positions, and if they don't, you know, I mean, here again, it's like we're talking about the championship team, you know, it's everything's got to gel. But at the very shortest, they're not going to see any returns off of a change in any shorter time than 6 months. Except, yeah, you renewed interest, but then they've got to hit. How many people that watch WWE don't even know there's a TNA? You know. How many times do you get questions of whatever happened to so-and-so, and it's somebody who's working with TNA?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean,
it happens.
It's just, but yeah, somebody's got to come in and take, you know, I've heard the reference that Heyman wants to be the head guy there, like the guy in UFC, you know.
Dana White.
Dana White. And so... Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, but that obviously there's a market there and success. You know, and Bischoff made the statement that what can professional wrestling learn from UFC? I mean, can he be that far out of touch? I mean, really?
I don't know how big of an MMA guy Bischoff is, because that just seemed like, you know, posturing the same way WWE says, you know, well, you know, UFC's not really competition to them, even though obviously they are, at least as far as pay-per-views go.
I wondered if he was just, you know, just blowing smoke too, because it's hard to believe, you know, that to be in a position of making decisions, or one of the decision makers, or one of the people that have influence on the decision makers, whichever you want to call him, or whichever he actually happens to be. The point is, you need to watch what's going on around you. That's as important as what you're doing. You know, so you're not looking like a bad copy of something, like the whole, you know, factional thing and taking over and that sort of thing. I've told any promoters that you might see something good on television. Don't do it in your show the next week, because isn't it cute? ABC Indies are pretending to be. We saw this on Raw last week, or we saw it on whatever. You know, it's. I'm not saying don't use it, but wait a year or wait 6 months until, you know. Don't just do it then. And I think that's part of the problem there. They've been a bad copy for a long time. Well, you know. Off and on, they've done something original, but for the most part, they haven't.
You know, one good thing I noticed in WWE right now, And I don't know if this is because USA's lost interest or what, but it seems like the guest GM thing is down to about exactly where it needs to be. If it's going to be on a broadcast at all, at least with just a short hit and sell whatever it is you're doing next and see ya. Is that something that's obviously it's run its course, but is that just USA losing interest in it, or has WWE finally, I think, realized that we're done with this?
Maybe it's just maybe it's just petered out on both sides, or just. It's a novelty thing to begin with, so maybe it's run its course, and maybe finding people, that obviously they've had, it's been a hit and miss thing of the people they pick. Some blend right in and don't do a bad job, and others, it's like trying to put a round peg in a square hole, but it doesn't work. This whole computerized general manager I think it was dead the first week. And you hear the people booing, and it's just, it's, but then when you listen to the dialogue that is given your top baby face, and you listen to some of the dialogue of some of the other people, you realize they are legitimately playing to children. It can't be perceived as any other thing, I don't think. I mean, really, John's, it's hokey. Now, it's somebody putting words in his mouth, but I mean, it's just so, He-Man from Saturday morning cartoons.
It's very safe. I mean, it's very simple and safe, although I'm sticking with the, as wacky as it is, and I can't believe I'm saying it, I'm sticking with this. Guess with the mystery GM thing for now, just because of, I think they're also booing Michael Cole as much as they're booing the whole idea. It's just, I don't know how long this can last for before you really need to pay it off. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the problem too is when you tease things of some magnitude and then you deliver something that's far less than, well, like Dixie's, big announcement is going to change the history of professional wrestling, right? She's crying. I mean, there may be a big announcement coming, but so far all the big announcements is going to change the history of wrestling have pretty much fizzled out, and it's become like crying wolf. So I think that, I think the whole, Michael Cole is not one of their favorite people because he's replaced the man, and you can't replace the man. But still, I just think it's hokey, right? And the payoff will be less than, it's not going to be Austin and it's not going to be Piper.
Let's just say they get you go out of left field and it's Bryan Danielson. Now it works for the story. It works for a lot of things and, it would be a big splash for him. But for the most part, the WWE viewer, would that be a disappointment?
Yeah, I think so. For the general viewer, yes. And I think so, Mike. Yeah, without getting too crazy about it. Yeah, absolutely.
I was thinking about that because, we'd all have probably a blast with it because it would be, okay, now let's see what they do with him. Because with Bryan Danielson, they've watched him for too long. He's too hard for me not to like. I'm always going to root for Bryan Danielson, so... it would be great for a big segment, but it's just, I wondered about that because we get stuck in this internet sort of bubble here a little bit too. And guys who listen to and watch a lot of wrestling, like the general WWE audience doesn't. They don't watch SmackDown. They don't watch anything else. They certainly really weren't watching NXT, and all they really know of it is what Nexus has been since they've been on Raw. So I was wondering, what you thought about that.
Yeah, I don't, it's, yeah, I don't think it's, well, because I think that would, if he were to come back in any way, shape, or form, it had to be wrestling. I mean, to make it, really make an impact and utilize him to the best of his ability, because that's what he was sent out on, right? Of course, to the general public, it wasn't perceived as that. I mean, that wasn't the way it was released in the storyline, but still. I'm going to ask a question. There were more chairs being swung on Monday night. Is that not violent? is it more violent to choke somebody with a silk tie or to hit them with a steel chair?
I still always would love to want to hear that full story when it ever gets told of, you know, and again, you know, the whole policy and everything else, it's, you know, why would it be one thing and not the other? But, you know, for a different time.
and when I talk about He-Man Saturday morning cartoon is, six-on-one handicap matches. That is, I mean, you don't even talk. I mean, that's, you roll your start rolling your eyes the minute you announce something like that. You know, it's just that is most assuredly, you know, and of course they didn't all wrestle at the same time, I know, and they finally did get to beat the hell out of He-Man, but still, you know, first of all, He-Man has got to be, what kind of, you know, psychedelic strokes is he on to be wanting to take on six or seven guys at the same time anyway, you know? I mean, come on. No, that's insane. But anyway.
he's a superhero. He's larger than life superhero.
Yeah, I know. You can't see me either. But that's what I'm
Hey,
Les, anyway,
I wanted to ask you, as we get close to taking a break and going to get our guests, I just wanted to ask you, what have you heard about Steamboat in the last week?
He's still in ICU.
Yeah.
And they had thought, you know, might be released, but that's not the case. And there's no timetable now. Yeah, so it's, you know.
So what seemed somewhat positive a week ago, now, I guess, in question?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's, there's no timetable. You know, it's, there's been a little progress made, but not what they were expecting, and again, for this thing to self heal, it could be a matter of months. I mean, that's, you know, from an informed source, I've heard, obviously as short as a month, but as much as three.
Wow.
Who knows? So there's got to be, you know, it's got to be monitored and everything through that period of time. So I mean, I'm don't get me wrong. Now, I'm not saying he's going to be in the hospital 3 months. That's the time that for something like this that bursts like that to heal itself, which is the case, you know, it has to repair itself.
Are you in contact with the family at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And are they at least holding up well?
Yeah, they seem to be, you know, obviously they have, you know, a lot of pressure on them too.
Sure.
And, you know, and of course, it would obviously be better if they were closer to home and family, too, probably, you know. But,
sure.
Well,
next time you talk to them, be sure to pass along the best wishes from me and Mike, I'm sure, and everybody at GWH.
I will do that. I will most surely do that.
All right. Tell you what, folks, we will go and take a break now, and we will go and get the guy you really want to hear. We're going to bring on Mr. Jim Ross here in about 3 minutes.
Hi everybody, this is Geddy Lee for RAD. To many of us, drunk driving is something that other people do. Certainly not one of our friends or relatives would do such a thing. When you see someone who's had too much to drink, about to get into a car, urge them to give up the keys and find alternate transportation. Always choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives, you should too.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Adopt Us Kids and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the GWH Radio Network. Each week, you can hear a variety of shows covering pro wrestling, MMA, and other professional sports, including Shot in the Dark with Jimmy Rave and Sal Renaro, The Sports Buffet with Chef Tim Dix and Rich Tate, The Dave and Danger Show with Dave Wills and Mark Danger, Ringside Rap with Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi, and Peach State Pandemonium with John Cannon, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. For all the latest on these programs and so much more news and information from the world of pro wrestling, MMA, and other professional sports, stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the Sports Buffet.
Fairy residence, Tooth speaking. Sorry, there's no credit fairy here. What's that? He magically raises your credit score? Yeah, there's no credit fairy. But you can improve your credit by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low. Money under your pillow? Sorry, kids only.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. Brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Ringside Rap. Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, Mike Sempervivi here with you, and we welcome to the show our featured guest for tonight, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be with you guys.
All right. You know what? Go ahead, Les. Sorry.
I was going to say, there's a voice I've missed hearing in a while. Jim, how you doing?
I'm good, Les. How are you doing today?
Not bad for an old guy. I'm looking forward to seeing you in a couple weeks in Charlotte.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, me too.
I was just going to lead off by making sure everybody does know that Jim Ross will be in Charlotte, North Carolina at the Hilton University Place for this year's NWA Legends Fan Fest. Of course, that's August 5th through 8th. If you don't know how to get there, go to nwalegends.com, get all the info. Jim, I'm sure you're very proud. You're getting to induct into the Hall of Heroes Danny Hodge.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to be able to induct one of your all-time favorite sports heroes, and a guy that I consider a great friend and certainly was a mentor to me when I got in the business back in the mid-70s. So, you know, that's it's always good to see wrestling fans. I don't make a lot of appearances, but that opportunity to induct Danny certainly put it over the top and was made it very difficult to say no.
Yeah, we had Danny on our show earlier this year, and of course we've already got it set up with Greg Price over there to make sure he's got a ring set aside for Danny and Les.
They're trying to get me killed, Jim. This is a whole story.
Les is too smart for that.
Yes, he is. Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
JR, a lot of people talk about your interest in MMA now and in the UFC, and you've blogged about it a lot. And we asked Danny when he was on, you know, about his opinion on MMA and on amateur wrestling today. A lot of people talk to you about MMA, but obviously amateur wrestling being a great base of it and really what has turned the tide of MMA to people in America. How involved are you, or how much do you stay up with any of the amateur wrestling?
Well, I'm, you know, I live in Norman, Oklahoma, and I'm 3 miles from the campus, so I go to a lot of the OU duels and their matches there, and so I try to stay as connected as I can. You know, here in Oklahoma, as a kid growing up, before the internet and before ESPN and all those things, before cable, you know, we all did this unusual thing called reading. And I read the daily paper, and in the daily paper, in the sports pages, they covered amateur wrestling as aggressively and as thoroughly as they covered any other sport in our state. So I've kind of grown up with it here in Oklahoma and have tried to stay engaged to it. I've kind of got re-engaged to it since wife Jan and I moved back to Oklahoma a few years ago. So I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy going to the duels and watching OU wrestle. They have a they're in a, you know, they wrestle a real good quality of opponents. You know, they'll have the Iowa States and the Iowas and all these good teams that around the country that come in, and so it's fun, and I still enjoy watching it.
ESPN does pretty good work as far as covering the NCAA finals, and it's always a rocking crowd, and Kyle Wellwood of Minnesota's win this year was really exciting. What can amateur wrestling do to try to incorporate some things, just off the top of your head, that could really help try to get that spirit and that atmosphere out there and get kids involved in wrestling again?
Well, I don't think it's anything unlike if you look at it like you would a college football team. When Oklahoma signs players, the players that are coming in get so much hype and so much their awareness of who they are and what they've accomplished and those type things are created. It's no different than wrestling on TV, or it's no different than the NFL. We all have our favorites, and it's that key word, you know, key term, making the emotional investment into whatever you're watching or you're supporting. So I think that, you know, in a nutshell, amateur wrestling could probably do a much better job of marketing their product in the regular season, so that it's not just the end of the year when fans of their product see it on a national basis. So, you know, when I was a young guy growing up in eastern Oklahoma, you know, the OU-OSU wrestling duel, the Bedlam series, usually was on local television. So it kept all of us young guys engaged. We knew who all the talents were. And, you know, when Jack Briscoe became a pro wrestler at about 65 or so, I was very well aware of Jack Briscoe long before he started wrestling for Leroy McGuirk because of his amateur status and seeing him compete on TV at Oklahoma State. And then before that, again, reading the newspapers, he was like Jim Thorpe. He was an all-around athlete at Blackwell, Oklahoma High School. So I just think a better job of marketing and letting us know who these kids are and why we should be supporting them. You know, I'll be honest with you. I've gotten to know, you know, pick up some names of some of the kids here at OU, but I basically go because, A, I like amateur wrestling, and, B, I'm a Sooner fan. I don't really go because there's a gregarious character out there that's bigger than life, like Steve Williams was, or, you know, some of the guys that wrestled at OU over the years. Danny Hodge was bigger than life. But, of course, it's not easy to replicate those types of individuals.
You know, I just wanted to let everybody know, in case anybody missed it, over the weekend, Mike Mooneyham, our good friend, who fills in here every now and then, wrote a great article on Hodge and got a lot of comments from you for the piece, and I enjoyed the crap out of that article. Great stuff, as always, from Mike, but, you know, just great stuff from you. I don't want to get too far away from the wrestling stuff, but I was captivated by the fact that you got to travel sitting across from Mickey Mantle once. What was that like?
Well, you know, I've been collecting Mickey Mantle memorabilia for probably 20-25 years, and I had started collecting Mantle memorabilia I don't remember what year it was, but it was way back there. And after Cowboy Bill Watts sold his UWF to Jim Crockett Promotions, I was living in Dallas, but I had made a commitment to my football officiating team that I would still come up to Oklahoma every Friday and would officiate our Friday night high school games. And, you know, I lost money every week. The only good thing is I think it was a $19 one-way fare on Southwest from Dallas to Tulsa at the time. But I still lost about 100 or two a weekend. But I made a commitment. I kept it. But on one flight, on a Friday, I was flying up and sitting across the aisle from Mickey Mantle, who was going to Tulsa to do a baseball card show on Saturday. And we just had, you know, it was a short conversation. I was so intimidated that I'd never asked him for an autograph. And he had cards already signed. He was just passing out when people come up to ask him. He already had them signed. So he was ahead of the game. I do remember that on the 45-minute flight, maybe, from Love Field to Tulsa, that he had seven screwdrivers. And I remember that because he was number seven, and he was drinking those screwdrivers like they were Gatorade. So, but we had a great visit, and it was really a thrill for me. And I'll never forget that day. It was just really neat. He told Wahoo McDaniel stories of playing golf, him and Lee Trevino and Wahoo playing golf and Preston Trails Country Club in Dallas. And I think between Trevino and Mantle, they generally took Wahoo's paycheck. So, or at least that was Mantle's side of the story. I think Wahoo probably would have told a little different story, God bless him.
No, you know what? Wahoo would come back to I remember Wahoo coming back with some of those trips to Charlotte and complain about them damn guys took my money. And I said, well, Eddie, Trevino's a professional golfer. Wouldn't you figure to beat him if he put his money on the line in a wrestling match? Well, I know, but I can beat him. I know I can.
Well, that was the deal. You know, they'd play Wahoo along. Trevino was a hustler. You know, he was from down in El Paso, and he was hustling golf when he was a kid. And, you know, Wahoo would be pretty competitive the first nine holes, and they'd up the bets on the last nine. And then Trevino would turn it on and end up winning the money from Mantle and from Wahoo. But they had a hell of a time, and I'm sure there was some serious drinking going on. And I don't know how their course etiquette was, but it was nobody was going to say anything to Wahoo McDaniel and Mickey Mantle and Lee Trevino, that's for sure.
I can't even imagine Mantle and Wahoo together. I mean, I've been with Wahoo on some of his tears, but all I've heard about Mantle, that must have been quite a duo for sure.
Well, it's a very charismatic pair, and you know, for again, a kid growing up in Oklahoma, we didn't have a lot going on. You know, athletics was a big thing. You know, Wahoo was a huge star at OU in the late 50s, and you know, he played on some great teams, and he went to the AFL, and then he got into wrestling, and that just fit perfectly for me because I was a pro wrestling fan and a college football fan and a pro football fan, and of course Mantle was every kid in Little League back in that era. You know, I was born in 52, so I was my last year at Little League was 1964, and the best player on the team always got to wear number seven. And I never wore number seven, but you know I enjoyed playing, and he was he was the king, and that's what put him in the same boat with Hodge. You know, Hodge was so famous here in the 50s as an Olympian, and this unprecedented, ridiculously hard to believe record at Oklahoma, that the time Hodge broke in for McGurk, he'd already won the Golden Gloves boxing championship. He had had a few pro boxing fights. When he debuted, you know, he was a star. Everybody knew Danny Hodge was. He was a star already, and so he was my hero in that era, and you know, my first full time traveling partner. And so I was really blessed to be around Danny Hodge all those years, especially in my early years. He was quite the policeman. You know, no one took advantage. I told Mike Mooneyham a story about Bob Sweetan taking some liberties and had blacked my eye, and they had butterflied it because, you know, heck, I couldn't afford to go. Making $25 a night, you can't afford to go to the doctor to get stitches. And there wasn't any doctors on call at the arena like there is now at in WWE, I can for sure. But Hodge saw me on TV, and might have been old Shiner, and what happened to you? And I said, well, you know, I kind of hem-hawed. He got the story out of me. And then ironically, the next week, that week in Oklahoma City, he wrestled Sweetan. And it was not a good night for Bob Sweetan, who was 300 and Hodge was maybe 220. And Hodge beat him like a government mule. He just beat him up. And of course, Sweetan won the match that night because Sweetan was getting ready to wrestle Cowboy in a program. But he paid the price for being a bully. Hodge did not like to be around bullies. And so I never had any more issues with Sweetan after that, ironically.
Jarrah, how are you coping with all this, I don't want to say free time on your hands now, but being an Atlanta Falcons fan, it would always amaze me that you would be working in wrestling and doing the announcing. Same thing with the XFL. When you're doing that and dealing with talent relations, you have always seemed to have so much incredible amount of work on your plate. What's it like actually being able to breathe for once?
Well, it's pretty good. You know, I'm not complaining. I still seem to stay pretty busy with my WWE projects. There's a kind of a schedule that I have on that as far as when I receive information or things to work on and a deadline to get it back. And so I'm staying pretty busy there. Today I worked on the THQ video game, and I'm working on that tomorrow and Friday again to try to make sure it's ready to roll by a 2011 rollout. I think they're going to try to roll it out prior to WrestleMania, WWE All-Stars, is what it's called. And it's really been, that's kept me pretty busy. And then I got our online business that we're trying to build with my mom's barbecue sauce recipe. And I have a buddy of mine that makes our beef jerky for us. He's been making beef jerky for 40 years commercially. And so he uses our recipe to make the beef jerky. And then we have a company up in Oklahoma City that's been around since 52, ironically, when I was born, and they're a third-generation company that makes our sauces and our ketchup. So between the website and trying to keep our customers happy and getting things shipped and my WWE work, I seem to be staying busy enough. You know, it was just about time to slow down a little bit, and I think that the good Lord was kind of tapping me on the shoulder a little bit here and there about my health issues. And, you know, for someone to have Bell's palsy three times, you know, heck, I didn't know what the hell it was when I got it the first time. And now I can pretty well explain it to anybody. But I thought it was time to slow down. And I still enjoy the business. And I'm a fan. And I still get the itch to go call a match here and there or to broadcast something, but I seem to be staying pretty busy, you know. And you got a wife, you always got some honeydews.
You know, Jim, you're doing some stuff with developmental again, and I know that's one of your passions, so that must be fun for you too.
Yeah, you know, it is, Les. I think it's important for us that have made a living in this business and that loved it from the time we were a kid, got lucky enough to get in it, and then to survive it. You know, I wasn't an athlete of the level that the guys were that were in the business. I wasn't related to anybody. I didn't have a friend that got me in. I kind of backed in and got discovered in college just promoting some spot shows by Bill Watts. And so I feel it's incumbent upon us to try to get back. It's more than just a job to me. It's been a part of my life. So I'll go to Sunday, for example. I'll do THQ. I did it today, Wednesday, or Thursday and Friday. I'll work on some WWE stuff on some payroll issues on Friday and Saturday. And then Sunday I'm going to fly to Kansas City and go to the pay-per-view. The Money in the Bank pay-per-view, and then I'll come back home Tuesday, and then Monday, and I leave again Tuesday to go to Tampa, and I'll be in Tampa at Florida Championship Wrestling's training center Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. So my schedule is I'm going to try to go to Tampa once a month and spend, you know, anywhere from 2 to 4 days evaluating and observing and helping where and when I can. These youngsters, young men and women that are trying to live the same dreams that many of us have had the opportunity to live. And, you know, I'm certainly not the guy to get in a ring with them and show them how to apply a headlock, but I can tell them some things from being a play-by-play guy and, you know, had some success evaluating talent over the years that might help them. At least that's the goal.
Well, I think that they'll profit from it. I really do, and I think that's. I'll tell you what, Rich and Mike, when working with Jim when I was with the company, with him being head of talent relations, was a real honor and a pleasure because He may have never taken, well, he's probably taken several bumps, but the, never having wrestled, he still is one of the boys, and he understands, and he tried so hard as best he could to balance things out to where the company profited, but the boys also were taken care of and given respect. And I think, Jim, I think that's something that needs to be said, because a lot of times the guy in your position is just looked at as the hatchet man, which is totally wrong, because you're just the messenger anyway. But I think the kids down there in Tampa are be, you know, honored and pleased to have you, and we'll honestly.
Oh, I hope so. You know, I'm looking forward to meeting them, and a lot of them I know, and a lot of them I knew their dad or their grandpa, whatever. You know, so you know, little things. You know, I talk a lot about you know. Being a professional and conducting themselves properly, being reliable, being dependable, keeping their word, saving their money, paying their taxes, doing some financial planning. You know, you got to plan for success, or the alternative is that you're going to fail. So I think that it's important that they understand that they do have an obligation to them, to their family, to themselves, to the company. And then good old Uncle Sam kind of expects what he's got coming. So none of those areas can be ignored, and they all got to be focused on. And I'm big on study. I think they should read a lot of books about wrestling where they, you know, they're going to learn something from every book that's written. They ought to watch a lot of DVDs, pick out somebody that they can identify with, or maybe somebody there, me, whomever, can help them. Hey, once you watch this guy's DVDs, this team, this individual, whatever, it just gives them a little bit more background. I firmly believe this. I believe that you cannot become a star if you only invest your time in your profession while you're at camp, I think, or at school, whatever you want to call it. You've got to invest on your off time, whether that's going to the gym, whether that's reading, that's watching DVDs. It's a full-time job, and just
Amen.
To go, you have a three-hour workout session, and those are the 3 hours that you invest in your profession. I'm wondering what you're doing with the other 21 hours. You know, like somebody said, I stayed pretty busy in my career, and it seems like it worked out okay. You know, I'm been around since 74 and still hanging in there, so and happy with it. So I think that it's things like that I might be able to help them, as opposed to saying, well, here's how I used to throw a drop kick. You know, that would be comical. You know, my in-ring opportunities were never – my one loss record was not real sterling on Monday Night Raw, and I got beat up by the best of them, but I they don't need to use me as an example for that. They need to use me maybe as an example in other areas of being dedicated to your craft and learning it and loving it.
Yeah, I think that's the key, don't you? I mean, seriously, the greats that you and I both have encountered have been guys who lived it and breathed it, and they had the passion for it. And I think that that's so much the foundation to make it a great star, no matter what kind of natural ability they may have or what they can be taught. If they don't have that passion and don't feel it, it don't work.
Well, you can really. There's so many fundamental things that can be taught, but you can't teach passion, and you can't teach instincts. That's the missing ingredient. That's the intangible. And you know, we got very fortunate in my tenure at WWE when I was in charge of the talent roster, with getting some guys that we were very blessed to get some guys that not only had physical gifts and skills, but they had the intangibles of having instincts and the overwhelming passion to be the best on the roster. You know, I've always said, and my philosophy was that I didn't see any use in signing anyone that either didn't have the ability or the desire to headline WrestleMania. If you just wanted to make the roster and make the team, and you were happy hitting ninth in the lineup, then that really wasn't a motivator for me to make sure we got your deal done. I wanted someone that had the skill set to be the headliner at WrestleMania, because then if you fall just a little bit short of that very elusive goal, then you're still in pretty good shape. You're still, you know, you're being a semi-main or a co-main event or things of that nature is not a bad place in life. And as long as you're doing your very best, and you can make a darn good living nowadays, if you're even if you're not in the main event, you can still make a great living. And if you save your money and you're smart and you start in your 20s, by the time you're 40, you should be financially secure if you've done everything the right way and lived within your means and had a plan. So that's kind of those are some of the things that I enjoy talking to the kids with one-on-one. And, you know, I tell the guys, I said, you know, it's not incumbent upon you while you're living here in Tampa to visit every strip bar in town. And a lot of you are going to visit them anyway, so it's not you're going to roll your eyes and you get in your car and leave. That old guy just said, man, I'm, you know, not to go to the strip bars. I didn't say not go. I just said, you know, don't make that your passion. You ain't got to notch your gun, you know, every two or three nights. You should be watching a DVD of somebody that you might be able to learn something from so that when you come to camp the next day, you're better than the day before.
Hey, I want to let me go ahead and ask a couple questions here, Mike. I wanted to ask you about just all the different announcers you've worked with over the years, you know, just going all the way back. I know about your love for Gordon Solie. We've all got that. And at least in terms of me personally, you are only behind Gordon Solie. But who out of all the great people you've worked with over the years, who do you consider just your favorite partner, or maybe who have you learned the most from?
Well, you know, if you're smart and to make it in this business, you got to be at least street smart. I think you try to learn something from everybody that you work with, and I don't think I've ever worked with a partner that I didn't learn something from. You know, I watched the Hero Matsuda Danny Hodge match probably 100 times. That Gordon Solie narrated,
right,
by himself, and it was a long match, and that was a great learning tool. Then I was able, because of where I was in the corporate structure at Turner, to get Gordon rehired, and I worked with Gordon some there in his latter days. He was my analyst, and he was reluctant to take that role, but I was. Not going to take no for an answer, because it was part of my dream was to work a match or two, you know, a show or two with him, and we ended up working a few, and I really enjoyed that. That was a selfish thing, but it was a personal deal that got to happen. I don't know that Bill Watts taught me so much as a color commentator, because he was the owner of the territory, and he was at times the number one star, and more often than not, he was always the final decision maker. He knew exactly where he wanted to go. He gave me words to use. If a fan favorite was to leave the ring, he's regrouping. If a villain leaves the ring, it was too hot in the kitchen type thing. They did the same thing, but you described it differently. You protected the baby face, and you wanted to vilify the bad guy. And you did that with your choice of words. So Bill taught me a lot there. You know, I enjoyed working. I worked with a lot of guys at Turner. Golly, you know, Jim Cornette was a great partner. Never lost words, obviously, and understood the business thoroughly. Kevin Sullivan was a good partner. I saw a match the other night on WWE 24/7 that I'd forgotten I'd done. And it was actually before I went to Cauliflower Alley Club. Because we talked about it there, where I did a few pay-per-views with Terry Funk. And Terry was excellent. He really was absolutely excellent. Great instincts and good, you know, natural timing. That was a good experience. I worked with Les in Smoky Mountain. That was Les was a veteran, and he had done a lot of broadcasting and wrestled for years. And that was a very rewarding experience. And then, you know, then I moved up to then I working with Bob Caudle was wonderful. I think Bob Caudle may be one of the most underrated wrestling announcers ever. He and of course, a lot of people will understand and will agree that Lance Russell is certainly one of the top two or three, whatever, announcers ever. But a lot of people out of Memphis, you know, and this generation just haven't experienced his work. And Lance was wonderful and a wonderful, classy man. But Bob Caudle was my partner when the Watts buyout occurred. Crockett put Bob and me together on NWA Pro Wrestling, which was in syndication. And Tony Schiavone and David Crockett were the A-team announcers. And I think they did Worldwide Wrestling, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, so I thoroughly enjoyed working with Bob. You know, you got to like, you know, you should like your partner. You should trust your partner. And Bob Caudle was one of the most underrated broadcasters I ever worked with. And I have so much respect for him. And then, of course, going to WWE, I worked in a three-man booth with Jerry Lawler. I worked with and Vince McMahon. That was a unique experience because we were three of us. Working with Lawler was probably the most comfortable fit that I had with anybody I've ever worked with. And that may have been because we just had so much time together. We were, you know, same generation, two Southern guys. Didn't have any issues eating fried food or barbecue, you know. Jerry didn't drink any beer, but I drank enough for both of us, so that worked out fine. I didn't like to drive, and he liked to drive. We liked to listen to the same music or sports talk. That was all good. So it was great working with Jerry. It was one of the greatest runs I've ever had. And probably some of my most spirited work was with Paul Heyman, because he was just so aggravating. And I told him this to his face, so this isn't, you know, knocking Paul. It's really a compliment. Paul's persona as Paulie Dangerously was so easy to dislike and so easy to get angry at that he had a real great gift for the as an antagonist. And what he would say on air, because I would get so wrapped up in the presentation and the product. You know, I never played the role of an announcer. I was just me, for better or for worse. And Paul would be was a great partner because he could seemingly light the fire under me on some shows that just absolutely, you know, I wanted to strangle him. So he was really good in that regard. So I worked with a lot of guys I like. I tell you, the first Clash of the Champions, I worked with Tony Schiavone, and that was a fun time. Tony and I got along well. We're both sports fans, longtime wrestling fans, and in that era, at that point in time, he was really on top of his game, and I was his analyst. He was a play-by-play guy, and I was the analyst, I think, for the first few Clashes, and that was good. So I really, you know, I've had partners I like better than others just because of tenure and time. You know, Lawler was like a pair of old you know, tennis shoes that you just don't want to throw away. They just fit good.
Sure.
And, you know, that may have been why we were split up, because we maybe got into that comfort zone and were too comfortable. I don't really know. But I really enjoyed working with Jerry, and it was always a, you know, I still talk to him about once a week. And more often than not, be honest, guys, you know, hard to believe, but we talk about a lot of things that don't have anything to do with wrestling. We're that good of friends. So I think that's why it worked on the air. I think that's why Jerry, and I get a lot of emails on this on our website. We liked King better when he was being a heel, and I don't know how that's subjective. It's their opinion. But I think it just became, we just got so comfortable with each other that there really wasn't a protagonist and an antagonist on the at the table. It was just two guys that were calling what they saw on the monitor and trying to make these guys bigger stars than they are or they could be, and told the story. So I've had some great partners. You know, I've had a lot of fun. And you know, I work with Ventura there in WCW. That was an interesting experience. He was very headstrong and very intelligent, very good, good timing. But I don't know that at the end of his run there, because of office politics in Turner Land, that he was really invested into the product. I'm not saying that he phoned it in. I just don't think he had the fire in him that that he did when he worked with Vince on Saturday Night's Main Event and other things in WWE. I think that he had kind of lost interest in the genre, and he knew that his days were numbered there because of the politics within the Turner organization. So that was sometimes got a little bit challenging, but it never was not fun. It just was more challenging because he had his own agenda.
Yeah, it sounds pretty reminiscent of just the same passion or lack thereof that seemed to happen to so many in that company. A couple more questions real quick, and then I'm going to throw it to Mike because I know he's got a series of questions for you. But you did some work for the Atlanta Falcons. How did that come about?
I had the opportunity to do a talk show on WSB AM 750 in Atlanta.
Right.
The general manager there had been the GM at a station in Tulsa. And we have become, I don't want to say best buddies, but we're associates and friends. And when he got the job, I gave him a call and congratulated him. And I'd already been living in Atlanta. And we got together and started shooting a breeze. And they had a 9 o'clock Sunday night kind of the wasteland. During football season, it was after the Georgia Football Coaches Show. And with the great Larry Munson, he was my lead-in, and that was a classic deal. And then at 9 o'clock, we had Wrestling with Jim Ross on the show, and I sold sponsorships. They said, we'll give you so many minutes. It's like the old barter deal in wrestling. You do the hour, you produce the show, and we'll give you X number of minutes, wherever it was, to sell. We won't pay you, but whatever you sell, you can keep. And I was fortunate enough to be able to sell all the time and made a few dollars on that deal. And it just basically started out with calls, taking callers. And then as it grew, they told me that we were getting three or four times more calls on their monitor, people trying to call in, than they were getting on the Georgia football show. I started getting guests on there. And so that's kind of how that came about. And then from that relationship and the ratings that we earned in 1992 when the Georgia Dome opened, WSB had their broadcast rights. They wanted to change everything up, and they brought in a new play-by-play guy, Bill Rosinski. They got rid of Larry Munson, and they hired me, and they put us with Jeff Van Note, their great center that's probably still working in their broadcast now, number 57. And Rosinski and I immediately became two of the most hated guys in Atlanta because it was seen that we replaced Larry Munson. So we followed the legend. But I did that season, and I really enjoyed it. The three of us had a three-man booth and did the Falcon games in 92, first year of the Georgia Dome. And then I did the first Peach Bowl ever played in a Georgia Dome. I think it was Mississippi State. Maybe Jackie Sherrill was coaching then, and North Carolina. Somebody can look it up. But nonetheless, had a real good year, and they were very happy. I thought that I would be probably brought back. People got over their dislike, and they were entertained by the broadcast. Things started going real well. I was hosting a Jerry Glanville show when Rosinski didn't feel like messing with Jerry. Everything got worked out real well. But then in 1993, I went to work with, that's when I left WCW and went to work for WWE. So I only got that one season there, but I really enjoyed it. I would be remiss if I didn't say that I could have made if someone would have said, hey, look, we're not going to use you in WCW, which is basically a political decision, but you got this football gig. I would have been very happy with the football gig and not leaving Atlanta. But something told me I had unfinished business to do in the wrestling business, and that's worked out really well ever since. You know, it's been 17 years and change.
Have you ever had a chance to actually work with Les, calling matches?
With who?
With Les.
Yes,
yeah,
we worked in Smoky together.
Jim Cornette and Smoky Mountain.
Oh, okay. See, I never got to see any of that.
I think WWE owns all that library now. And, you know, I'm sure somewhere down the road they'll pop up in a DVD or, you know, they're talking about creating a network in the next year or two on basic cable is how I understand it. And I'm assuming it'll be on satellite TV.
Yeah, you can, the Night of Legends DVD or tapes or whatever is floating around out there somewhere. That was the first night we ever worked together.
Yeah, that was in Knoxville, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you, Mike and Rich, how easy this guy is to work with. We had never worked together before. WWF was in Cincinnati. Jimmy told me to come down and talk to you and JR a little bit about this. And I guess we actually talked 15 or 20 minutes just about, you know, outline of what the format was going to be and so forth. And that was it. And so anyway, the point I'm getting to here is we took our first break at the Night of Legends, and in the back they get a drink and so forth, and Terry Funk came up to me and he said, well, you know, I've been watching the monitor back here, and he said, now that's the way a wrestling match is supposed to be called, the way you guys are calling. He said, how long you worked together? I said, tonight. He said, what do you mean tonight? I said, tonight. We never worked together before tonight. He said, oh, bullshit. I said, no, Terry, but tonight was the first night. And he wouldn't buy it until I finally convinced him, but that's just how easy Jim is to work with.
Well, I appreciate that. You were easy, too. It was just, You just don't try to over, you know, you just try to embellish what you're seeing and watch the monitor and tell your story and put the talent over and make them bigger stars than they are and just engage yourself as a fan. You know, that's how I looked at it. And you've got a little bit of gift for gab, and Les and I both had no issues with that. You know, we just told the stories. You know, the guys worked their tail off and Cornette had booked a good show, and the matches all had meaning, and you knew why every match was taking place, and you knew why everybody was on the card was there, and so then it was incumbent upon us just to tell that story, and that was a good night. They had a nice house, and the show seemed, as far as I remember, it was a good solid wrestling show.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And there's something else JR and I have in common is we were able to understand our very difficult friend Jim Cornette.
Hey, plus Les may have had the best head of hair you ever worked with.
What's that?
I said Les may have had the best head of hair you ever worked with.
Yeah. I tell you, Cornette was like, I used to tell him, I said, you know, you're like Ebb on Green Acres on crack. He's a brilliant guy, without question. And there's no one that is more passionate about pro wrestling, old school pro wrestling, than Jim Cornette. Nobody that I know of. And he's a great historian. But he loved it. And you know, he put everything, his heart and soul, in that little promotion. And he booked those shows as with every bit of creativity and logic and passion that he could. And then, you know, two guys like me and Les going in there, you know, it was, heck, if you hadn't done your best, you'd have felt guilty. At least, I know both of us would have. I certainly wasn't going there for the pay. I wasn't there just for the payday.
But, you know, that's the thing, too, that you guys, that little promotion with the talent and with, it was, the atmosphere was great. Everybody was positive. And it was fun, was it not, Jim? I mean, it wasn't going to work.
We had a good time.
It was going to have a good time.
It was a good time, and I went to some high school gyms and some places I had never dreamed of. Man, you talk about coming off of Clash of Champions and Omnis and all these places, and then going to some place in West Virginia at a high school gym and doing TV, and it was quite the off-Broadway experience. But I still had a great time. You know, once the bell rings and the matches start, it's all you just fall into place and get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, before anything else, I read you had done an interview someplace, Jim, and you had told a story about you driving Leroy around somewhere to find he was going to kill somebody or something. I never forget who it was. Tell that story if you would, please.
Oh, Ted DiBiase. Yeah, he was going to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have a Facebook page, and there's the video of my little speech at the Cauliflower Alley Club this year. I told that story, and to make a Reader's Digest version. Leroy, of course, was the promoter in Tulsa, former NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion when it was really significant back in the day, and he was totally blind. He lost one eye, and he's like 9 or 10. Won a national championship at Oklahoma State, which was Oklahoma A&M then. So he was a legit tough guy, a successful pro, lost his eye at the height of his career in 1951, if I'm not mistaken. And so I was making $100 and a quarter a week and driving him, buying him whiskey and cigars and getting to his hotel room and feeding him and stuff. And so we were driving to Shreveport from Tulsa, and he pulled out a big old gun and put it in his lap, and it was pointed at me, and as it was laid in his lap, and he's drinking whiskey out of a bottle, and I said, Leroy, what do you need that gun for? And he said, well, when we get to Shreveport, you're going to help me kill Ted DiBiase, because the legend had it that Ted was, who was single at the time, by the way, was dating Leroy's high school daughter. She was a senior in high school, like he was 18. She might have been a freshman in college, 18, 19 years old, and Leroy had got wind of it from one of his compadres in the office, and his mission was to go kill Ted DiBiase. And I told that story at Las Vegas in April, and Ted was in the front row, and his wife was just laughing herself silly. And of course, I never was accomplished a murder. I called Bill Watts on the payphone, and he was writing TV in Shreveport, and I said, your partner is drunk and has a loaded gun. And then he caught his pants on fire, and God, it was I had to get him out of the car and try to put his crotches on fire, his pants, and it was a hell of a scene, I'll tell you. And you make a great scene in a movie, I can promise you. But that was what you dealt with when you're a green kid just breaking in the business. You did what you were told, and not that I would have helped facilitate murder, don't get me wrong, by the time we got to Shreveport, Leroy had passed the needle had pegged on the drunk meter, and he just wanted to go to bed. And of course, Ted, to this day, thank God, is still up with us, and he laughs about that story. But it was it's quite the experience, and there are a lot of stories like that because it was kind of martial law down in Louisiana when you were in that territory. It was wild and crazy. There were no security barricades, and there are a lot of inebriated Cajuns that believe what they were seeing was gospel, and man, it could get tense. And as a referee, you learned very quickly that you left the ring on a hot night with the bad guys, because that's where the cops were. You didn't wait around and help the good guy up, then you walk back to the back and take about four or five. I got punched in the face so many times that I learned I'm not doing this again. I'm going out with the bad. There's a hot finish, and the bad guys win, man, I am going with them to the locker room, because that's where the cops are going to be.
There you go.
It seems like everybody that worked in Louisiana always has a story of, at one point or another, thinking that they were going to die. What was the worst situation you were ever in there where you figured, I'm really not getting out of here?
Well, anytime, the only money the guys made was at the live events. There was no... It's not like today where you have marketing, you get marketing and royalties and action figures and trading cards and all these foam fingers and things. We got plenty of fingers down there. They weren't foam. one of the heroes got lost in a controversial fashion, you ran the risk of having issues, and it was just a territory where people were very passionate about the product. It was the only wrestling show they saw, and then TBS came along, but until that time, and then USA somewhere in that neighborhood. But basically speaking, the average fan had an antenna on his house, And that's how they watch wrestling. They watch on their local show, and those shows with our owner were booked to elicit emotion. And, you know, it wasn't, let's make everybody happy tonight. More often than not, when you programmed a town every week, there was more angst and more anger and more jeopardy built every week until you got to the crescendo. And that's just the way it was. And, you know, you had to be very careful. I mean, I've had hot situations where I had Lake Charles one time where the city police had a car in front of me and a car behind me with a couple of guys riding with me. I think Akbar and somebody else, Skandar Akbar and somebody else, and he had done a dirty deed. And, of course, then they see him riding with the referee, so they know the fix is in. And, you know, the fans are pissed off, and they want you to pull over. They want to re-engage you on this situation. And so we were escorted out of town more than one time. And you just keep driving. And that's why the old-timers always tell you, let's get gas before we go to the arena, because you didn't want to stop in town on a hot night. And I'm talking about weather hot. I'm talking about a hot night in the arena and get gas. And you sure as hell didn't stop at the local Waffle House where you just got through wrestling and, you know, get you some greasy eggs and bacon. You kept on driving.
Yeah, I had a great opportunity to grow up listening to you and listening to Bob Cottle, which is one of the reasons I love him so much. Both of you guys for different reasons. One of the reasons I love Cottle was because he seemed, you know, being a weatherman down there, and he always seemed genuinely surprised, and that's why I, you know, like Lance Russell too, about what they were seeing and how they presented it as far as from their point of view. I know you watch Ring of Honor. Mike Hogwood has had a very distinguished career doing football and working for Jefferson Pilot for years. I think he's done a really great job and developed really great on Ring of Honor TV. What do you think about Hogwood and how he's come along?
Well, I think from where he started and with his background being in mainstream sports, he's done extremely well. You know, I think he probably doesn't get a lot of help other than Cornette doing some work with him there. But if I understand it, they voiced that show over in Denver, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I'd be wrong about that. And then when you go there, you know, you're kind of swimming, you're kind of going solo. You don't have a lot of somebody in your ear. You don't have somebody that's sitting there with you or give you the rundown or what you want to, you know, talk about or the key points in the match. You know, I've always liked broadcasting that my best nights were when I knew less information. I always understood the principles of the adversaries and what roles they played. I always understood why they were competing against each other. So I think that then you let your natural instincts take over and watch the monitor. The director's going to put on that monitor what the guy at home is seeing on his TV. And that's all you should be interested in. Unless there's obviously exception to that rule from time to time, but not much, not often. Occasionally, but not often. So, if I were Mike, I would just simply, as long as he can get down, understand the principles of the business and the fundamentals of each guy's role and what their personal issues are and why the match is, why is Duke playing North Carolina and why is that a big game? Who are their star players? Why do these players have a rivalry? You can transfer the same skill set right back into pro wrestling if you choose to. So he should just let his instincts take over and call the game, call the matches like he would call the game, call what you see, and not try to be over the top or try to be, you know, overly sensationalistic and, you know, leave something at for the end. But, you know, I catch you Ring of Honor from time to time. I think the kids wrestle on that show a little too fast for me. I think they probably could tell a better story and a better. No, I'm not talking about, you know, guys roll their eyes. Well, JR's old; he doesn't understand. Maybe I am old. That's true, and I may not understand, but I think I do. That I'm not advocating they get somebody in a headlock like Danny Hodge had Luthez in a headlock in a 90-minute draw in Joplin, Missouri one time, where they basically worked in and out of that one headlock for the whole 90 minutes. I'm not advocating that in today's time. All I'm saying is that you can't do, you can do four things maybe instead of doing eight things. And the four things you do will have more significance than the eight things do cumulatively. But that's not Mike's issue. That's the wrestler's pace. And that's just maybe what the promotion thinks that the fans are demand and they have to have is a frenetic pace. I happen to believe that you can slow it down a little bit and tell a more believable story that the fans will more emotionally invest in than when, by the time that match is over, then your recall is a little bit challenging. You saw a lot of great spots. You saw a lot of great things, but what did it all mean? What do you take away from it? And that's kind of how I look at that. But I think it does a good job, you know, to answer your question. For a guy that doesn't have a background in it and doesn't do it full-time, so to speak, he does a real good job. I think his Jefferson Pilot experience probably helps him there.
Now, I know Rich got another question for you, but I kind of want to ask you a little bit of an off-the-wall one. Restaurants open and close all the time. They're very difficult to run for people who are there even full-time. Your restaurant was successful, and how hard was it to put trust in other people to run that restaurant when you were on the road? And just what was that experience like a little bit, being the owner of that restaurant?
Well, we had a great partner. You know, my wife and I own 48% of that place, and my partner owned 41%, and then we had some investors that owned the rest of it, and he was head of Steak and Ale, and he was head of one of the top executives of Outback Steakhouse, and he's a restaurateur, my point, and he had several successful restaurants here in Oklahoma and the surrounding states. We were the only barbecue restaurant that he had, we were under his infrastructure. We were in there under their corporate umbrella, so I had all the confidence in the world and still do in our game plan. We just never factored in that the economy would be so challenging beginning in 08, and when you can go out and buy go to Taco Bell and eat for $2, or you can have all the baby back ribs at the Golden Corral for $10, or you can go buy a $1 Whopper at Burger King, it's kind of hard for a single entity to compete with that. And the economy took a real hit here, and as it did a lot of places. And so, then my health issues came up in October again, and we just decided that, you know, we had an opportunity to divest ourselves of it. It was not fun, and it wasn't, a good experience saying goodbye to your people. But I don't regret, neither does my wife or my partner, that we started it. We had 07 was a great year, most of 08 was a great year, and then we battled for half of 08 and all of 09, hoping things would turn around. Our food got great reviews. Our service was good. We just didn't have enough people coming through the door. That was the bottom line, how that worked. And so we had to shut her down. But, you know, I don't have any regrets on that. And I'm soon going to be putting some of the menus and the glass, the cups and the unused sauce bottles, squirt bottles. We're going to put them on our website one of these days and for souvenirs if people want to buy those. And they've indicated that there's an interest. But it was a tough decision. We knew it was a volatile business when we got in it, and we knew there was some risk involved. But, you know, I don't have any regrets. I did three things in that period of time. We opened the restaurant in 07. I went to the Hall of Fame, and WWE's Hall of Fame in 07. That was really neat, really cool. I opened the restaurant. We opened our website and started selling product, and I got and then we wanted to get our products in the grocery stores. Two of the three of our agenda have been very successful. Our online business is very good. It's up about 200% over last year. A lot of repeat business because we make good sauce. My mama didn't make any bad stuff. And then our barbecue sauce and our ketchup are the number one selling barbecue sauces in four of the grocery stores here in Norman, and they're a real good, consistent source of business. So, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. I wish the restaurant had made it, but it was a great experience, and I learned a lot. And who knows, you know, maybe someday we'll revisit that whole agenda under a different format. But it was mixed emotions, but mostly good.
And, of course, you know, Jim talks about his website. You can always go there and check out his blog, check out his store, many other things of interest at JRSBARBQ. That's JRSBARBQ.com. Jim,
Rich, let me throw in here a minute. Jim, you're going to have some of the sauce at FanFest in Charlotte, aren't you?
Yeah, we're going to bring bringing some sauce and some ketchup. It's our original inner hot sauce. We're going to have a little barbecue on Thursday night, kind of an informal, kind of a casual thing. The promoter's going to have the sauce for sale. I'm going to sign the bottles, and I'm going to ship them to him, and he's buying it, and then he's going to sell it at his convention. And so folks that, you know, haven't bought it online and are going to be in Charlotte can have a chance to take a bottle or two home with them and make it easy. But our deal is pretty simple. You know, we package all this stuff together, and then we pay for the shipping. So we offer free shipping anywhere in the United States for our products. So it's not a bad gig. So I hope that folks will try us out and visit our site. I enjoy answering their Q&As. They're one of my favorite parts of the day. You know, I'll get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and hammer out, you know, 20 or 30 Q&A questions and enjoy the interaction with the fans. It's always good to see what's on their mind, what's their hot button this week.
Hey, Jim, just a couple more questions real quick, and then we'll wrap up. One, being that, of course, WrestleMania coming to Atlanta next spring, that, of course, being a big deal to me, being the only one from the show here that's actually based in Georgia. But any idea, any hope on who we might be seeing going in the Hall of Fame?
You know, I really don't have any idea. I think that if you look at precedent in many instances, there was sort of either a overall theme or a regional theme. Example being WrestleMania 25 in Houston, the Funks went in, Steve Austin went in, Texas guys.
Sure.
Is my thought here, and Bill Watts went in, an Oklahoma guy. In Florida, the year before, when Ric Flair went in the Hall of Fame, it was really Florida flavor. You know, Gordon went in, and the Briscoes, and Eddie Graham. So using that as a rule of thumb, and that's really, I'm guessing, I got your guess is as good as mine. There are people in that were very significant, and there are so many that were significant in the TBS wrestling days, the Georgia Territory days, that one would think would be in consideration. You know, you'd think that the Freebirds, Arn Anderson, maybe Mr. Wrestling 2. You leave so many guys out and you start naming guys. And,
right.
And those are far from official. I'm just saying that if you look at the precedent set in previous WrestleManias, and if this Atlanta WrestleMania at the Georgia Dome has a somewhat of a Southern or a Georgia flavor, that those guys would be obvious candidates, one would say.
Sure. And, of course, my last question for you before we wrap up. In the great NCAA conference realignment that never came about, Oklahoma was quite possibly, I know they were being courted by the SEC in case the Big 12 split up. If that would have happened, would you have rather them followed Texas to, say, the Pac-10, or would you have rather seen them come on over to the SEC?
Well, the issue there is that there's a little bit of miscommunication on that, I think, in a general sense, is that Oklahoma will always play Texas, and they'll always play them the second Saturday in October in the Cotton Bowl, as long as unless Jerry Jones gets his way, and the alumni and the boosters and all of us fans, almost a man, woman, and child, don't want to move out of the Cotton Bowl. Cotton Bowl has got so much rich history. So Oklahoma would always play Texas, like we would have, we did all those years when they were in the Southwest Conference and we were in the Big Eight.
Right.
So if Texas had gone to the Pac-10, Oklahoma still would have played them. I know Oklahoma had the opportunity to go to the SEC. That invitation was extended, as I understand it, from high-ranking officials here at this university. They also were courted by the Pac-10 to make it a Pac-16. And at the end of the day, they decided to keep the Big 12, or there's 10 teams now, at least for, there's 12 this year, but I don't know how, Nebraska's leaving after this year, and Colorado probably will.
Right.
So the Southeast Conference would have been a great challenge. I think if just being a fan, I'd a lot rather take my chance on Saturday playing in the Pac-10 than I would playing in the SEC. SEC is by far the best football conference in America in college football. And Big 12 South is not a bad division with Oklahoma and Texas and A&M and Oklahoma State. And Texas Tech has been good. They were until Mike Leach left. I don't know how they'll be now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I that was an interesting. That would have been a really interesting situation because we would have obviously played in the SEC West, and that would have put us in there with LSU and Georgia. Georgia's in the West, right?
Georgia's in the East. I believe they would have ended up moving, I'm thinking Vanderbilt? I don't know. I saw like two or three different scenarios.
Yeah, well, I know Oklahoma was invited, and I'm glad that we kept our old rivals, as it were. And I think that in 4 years, when the TV deals are coming around again, you're going to see all the same discussion again. I think it's going to end up with four 16-team super conferences with two divisions in each conference. They'll all have a conference title game, and it will may be the forerunner to a playoff system. I think that's the where it's headed because of the TV money. Everything's about TV money, and
sure.
That's kind of where I see it. But, you know, I'm going to – I looked at a – I was looking at my schedule today, ironically, and Brock Lesnar's next fight is October 23rd, and I've had two or three invitations to come to that fight, and I'm going to have to pass on it because Oklahoma plays at Missouri that day. And then WWE has a pay-per-view the next day in Minneapolis. So I look at it like I'm going to travel north to Minneapolis, but I'm going to have a little stop-off in Columbia, Missouri, and go to the football game and then get to Minneapolis either Saturday night or early Sunday morning and do my day job.
There you go.
So I have to do my planning. I don't have a lot. I got more free time than I've ever had, but I'm not going to be booked for being a vagrant. I'm still busy, and I'm still having some fun and trying to build our website, and I enjoy my WWE stuff, and I miss calling matches, of course. That's in my blood, and I don't say that in a, you know, boy, he's bitter. I got nothing to be bitter about. My career's been wonderful. I got to call some of the greatest stars in the history of the business ever at call their matches, and I feel blessed to be able to do that. Was, you know, sitting at the table when we got great ratings on when the cable was just exploding on Monday nights, and that Attitude Era was really a unique experience. And but I had fun in the late 80s in Atlanta, and I had a hell of a lot of fun in working for Cowboy and going to Shreveport and doing that, spending every Thanksgiving and Christmas with this cranky ass in New Orleans before the Superdome. And I got to spend 3 days with Muhammad Ali. We shared a suite together. Had a common living room and two bedrooms. And that was 3 days of my life that I'll never forget. That if I was smart, and obviously I'm not, I would have written a book about that. But when I do write a book, my experience with Muhammad Ali will be included in at least one of the chapters because it's just too good not to write about.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back just to just talk a little bit about that. Well, Jim, it's been truly an honor to have you. Always a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for being so gracious with your time tonight.
Oh, you bet. I enjoy always talking wrestling and hooking up with you guys. It's good to talk to Les, and Les, I guess I'll see you in Charlotte, huh?
Yes, see you in a couple of weeks. Is Jan coming with you?
No, I got. She got to stay home and mow the lawn. And, no, I'm kidding. I think she's going to hold down the fort and help my. You know, we got our little operation, our online stuff is. There are three of us that do this job. My sister-in-law handles the shipping, and we moved her down here from Pittsburgh to Norman. And my wife helps her, and I do the blogging and the Q&As. And we have a webmaster, and he helps with, you know, technical things. But it's basically a little family operation, and I hope that folks will at least try us out. And, you know, I don't know if we got the best barbecue sauce they ever have because everybody's got their preferences and their likes and dislikes. But this is the same recipe that basically that my mom made when I was a kid, and we really are partial to it. And if folks will give it a try, we appreciate that. And we make good beef jerky. And I even do a deal where I bought a bunch of our last cookbook. The nice thing about the cookbook is it's got Trish Stratus and Stacy Keever on the cover and some fat guy with a hat. But I got a deal for $19.88. It's all in. So it's, you get the book, you get a personalized autograph, and we pay the shipping. So a fair way and doing it the right way, hard work, and it'll always come out in the end. Just work hard. Things will work out for you.
So here you go.
Well, God bless you, all my right. friend. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Charlotte. We'll sit down and catch up a little bit.
Okay, Les.
All right, Jim, you take care and have a
all
good
right,
night.
All right, Rich, Mike, thank you guys. You guys have a great night. Appreciate being on.
You too, man.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Of course, the great and legendary Jim Ross there, spending just a little bit over an hour with us. Absolutely fun. We'll be back here in a minute just to talk about that and a little bit more.
Hello, this is Robin Zanner.
Hello, this is Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick for Rad.
Some people think it's fun to drive drunk, but that's unacceptable.
Be smart. If you drink,
don't drive.
Think ahead and choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives, and so should you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
To be a good father is the most important job in a man's life, but it doesn't have to be hard. Play catch, go to a park or visit a zoo. Help your child with their homework. Sit down together for dinner. Ask them how their day was. Things get busy, and sometimes we all fall short, but the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today.
Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the GWH Radio Network. Each week, you can hear a variety of shows covering pro wrestling, MMA, and other professional sports, including Shot in the Dark with Jimmy Rave and Sal Renaro, The Sports Buffet with Chef Tim Dix and Rich Tate, The Dave and Danger Show with Dave Wills and Mark Danger, Ringside Rap with Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi, and Peach State Pandemonium with John Cannon, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. For all the latest on these programs and so much more news and information from the world of pro wrestling, MMA, and other professional sports, stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the Sports Buffet.
In 1977, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. The odds of that same boy winning the U.S. Open twice, 1 in 1.2 billion. The odds of him having a child diagnosed with autism, 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Okay, back on Ringside Wrap, myself, Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi here with you, and we're here on the home stretch. Guys, for Jim Ross to basically just give us, an hour and, 15 minutes, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Jim's a good guy. He really is.
Yep.
What I said earlier about working with him when he was head of talent relations there, I meant it sincerely. Because the job like that, you're being paid by a company, and yet if you understand the talent, you got to realize their side of the coin too. And I think Jim, always, as far as I was concerned, in all my dealings, he was very, honest, fair, and professional, and a good guy to deal with.
We've had him for a couple of the tribute shows we've done, and the Gary Hart show, the Jack Briscoe show, and then. Never anything less than generous and gracious with making time for you for whatever you got going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always a class act.
I'm going to get a play around with the microphone a little bit in Charlotte.
Oh, are you?
Yeah. I didn't know it until just a couple of days ago. But, I'm going to do color on the Saturday night show and the Sunday afternoon show. I guess they're taping those for DVDs later. Dave Marquez is producing the thing and is the man on the scene with the backstage interviews and stuff like that. Rowdy James is going to be my broadcast partner, and the main event on Saturday night is Brian Danielson and Adam Pearce for the
right.
NWA title.
Right.
And Greg Price is working on getting a guest commentator to sit in with us on that. I won't say who at this point, if it works, it'll be great. Because I'm not sure it's locked in yet, but anyway, I didn't know I was going to do that, but that's good. That's good. I'm looking forward to it. It should be some good matches. Davey Richards is on the show, besides this main event, and, Caprice Coleman, who we've had on the show here.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I've said to anybody, if you haven't seen Caprice wrestle, you really should. He's one of the better indie guys out there, plus a great promo, which he may or may not get to do there. But as far as my schedule, I think Bob Cottle and I are going to do autographs a couple hours on Friday morning, and then do photographs a couple hours late Friday morning, and then the banquet's Friday night, and then the show Saturday night. And Sunday afternoon, and it's going to be old home week. Gerald Briscoe, didn't mention that to JR, but Gerald's going to be there too.
Yeah,
I haven't seen him in a while. And when we were both young and single, we cut a pretty wide path through the Carolinas and Virginia back in the 70s. So, but yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm kind of looking forward to seeing the matches and getting the rust off.
There you go. Hey, Mike, catch us up. We're down to, I guess, about 12 minutes. Catch us up with some MMA stuff.
Well, I guess the biggest thing that everyone's kind of hearing about right now is the possibility of Bobby Lashley basically being the headliner of the Houston Strikeforce show on August 21st. Now, he wouldn't actually be in that King Mo, their 205-pound light heavyweight champion, Muhammad Lawal. It's facing off against Rafael Cavalcante in a title bout. There's also the 185-pound middleweight championship between Jacare Souza and Tim Kennedy that's going to be taking place as well. This is the belt that Jake Shields vacated when he was fired/quit after he showed up a couple days after the last CBS Strikeforce show showed up on the WEC pay-per-view sitting next to a very, very wide grinning Dana White. But obviously Lashley's name being the biggest thing, he's going to get a lot of the focus of that show, which is going to be airing on Showtime. As of now, nothing's been worked out past this point with CBS. What most people are really figuring is come football season in the fall, we're going to end up seeing it again on there. But there's still been no commitment made, which is one of the reasons that Strikeforce will never say they're not going to work with Dave Bautista. Obviously, they want to work with him. He went to the Cesar Gracie camp where he trains there apparently anyway, or was partially training there. Went in to see what he could do, and they would love to have a Lashley Bautista freak show matchup. And I'm not sure. It's not a competitive fight if you look at it, but it would be good for them and for their ratings and to gain interest and everything else, which That's they have to throw things like that at the wall to try to compete and stay up there. And even if it's just speculation, I mean, yeah, I would bet on, you know, continuing to see them feeding into it no matter what. You know, their heavyweight champion Alistair Overeem was involved in a bizarre story over the weekend. A lot of people, they look back at Pride when it comes to Japanese MMA, and they, one thing about Japanese MMA, it was messy. It was disorganized. There's no commission. It was underhanded. It was a lot of things. Now, a lot of that was shielded by the fact that there was, it was so big there. It was so incredibly big, drawing 90,000 people, you know, to an outdoor arena is, you know, pretty, is an amazing thing, or whatever the total was for their K1 Dynamite show that they had. It was a ridiculous amount of people, and that's how big it was. And those big, larger-than-life super fights that they had shielded the fact of all of this bad stuff that kind of happened underneath. And this past weekend's Dream Show was a lot of that, a lot of the worst of Japanese MMA, and what was really a symbolic end for Pride as Shinya Aoki defeated Tetsuya Kawajiri in the main event to hold on to his 155-pound Dream title. Aoki was the guy that some people may remember losing to Gilbert Melendez on that ill-fated left past CBS Strikeforce show where he was blown out in a 5-round decision that, you know, really bored people who weren't big MMA fans. It was just complete domination. He came back to beat Kawajiri. You know, he said after the Melendez fight, this shows you where Japanese MMA is at right now, and they're having problems. Strikeforce's champion Alistair Overeem was scheduled to fight Rico Rodriguez, a former UFC heavyweight champion who's had a lot of ups and downs in his life. He apparently was in shape. He went over. The fight was scheduled to take place on Saturday. He flies over Thursday just to be told that Overeem decided to not take the fight. Overeem has said, you know, he's been on vacation. Apparently there seemed to be no reason, there was no reasoning to believe that he would actually take this fight in hindsight, but it was one of those bait-and-switch things that Japanese MMA is known for. I mean, calling up guys on 3 days' notice and, you know, a week's notice and paying them to come in, it's a sloppy situation, which was, you know, very embarrassing for Dream. Also, what was embarrassing is a former UFC guy, Jake O'Brien, who's fought as mostly a heavyweight his entire career, but he had dropped down to 205. Well, they're having this 205-pound tournament taking place. He showed up at the weigh-in at 226 pounds. He was able to cut down to 212 before the doctors, which is amazing in Japan that they would actually say this, were actually, you know, saying he cannot lose anymore no matter what. The fight took place anyway. It, you know, instead of it not happening for the light heavyweight position, they let that go too, and O'Brien ends up getting choked out in 31 seconds. It was kind of, in a lot of ways, all the worst of what, you know, Japanese MMA has been, just, you know, glowing because the fights on top have been so weak, especially compared to what the UFC is offering.
All right. What else is going on this week, guys? What do you know we can fit in here in just a couple minutes?
How about there's a supposedly new promotion forming in Florida? That's got interest, is it in the Mets?
One of the Wilpon family members.
Yeah, supposedly Vader's already signed, but they're trying to keep everything else under wraps. But let me say this, no offense to Leon, but here you go. I don't care how much money you got, you're not going to go national with a bunch of veterans. You know, you got to build some new stars.
Yeah, I just checked my email, and it's talking about the story, and what it says in here is apparently several former WWE and TNA names have been signed up to the project, including Leon, Vader, White, and Sean Waltman. Sean Waltman?
Well,
I don't care. Sean's got his demons, for God's sakes. But he's a hell of a little hand. He really is.
But it don't matter.
It don't matter. How many? How about the guy in Chicago a number of years ago who had won the lottery and blew it all, and tried to do TV? Of course, he bought time on stations around the country. He paid extras to come sit and watch him tape. I would have bought it. I wish I was Chicago when I was doing that. I go sit around for, I don't know what they were paying. But anyway, again, you know, he tried to build around veterans. And it's going to take time. Time. Mike asked earlier about time. Starting from scratch is, you know, you better have some money to throw away.
Yeah, well, it's no different than any other business. I mean, you got to be willing to lose money.
Yeah.
For what? At least what's the mantra? At least for a couple of years.
3 years, 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the 5-year plan.
And you know, again, you could take somebody who's been a major player in TNA or in WWE or in NOAH, and that there's no assurance that who you put them, you know, because of who you put them with, the atmosphere you present them in, the storylines, et cetera, et cetera. No, there's no guarantee they're going to get over for you anyway. I don't care what you pay them or how high profile you're on television, you know. It's all got to come together. It's all got to gel. So, it's great. Again, I'd love to see 5 major promotions. It would make it keep everybody on their toes and put a lot more guys to work in front of the camera as well as behind the scenes. But, man, this guy's better be ready to dump some money. And I don't see who's out there that, again, there's no game changers. There's no game changers around right now. There's just not. There's some good solid veterans, some good solid workers, but nobody that you can take and build a promotion around and be sure it's going to have everybody talking around the water cooler tomorrow morning.
Well, you know, bottom line is, how long has TNA been at this? And somebody can literally sit there and say, well, you know, TNA would have been farther if they'd have done this, 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 and this. Well, that's all fine and good, but still, I don't buy that all their mistakes is clearly what's held them down. I think bottom line is it's too damn hard to get a good TV deal that's going to work for you. That's going to have reach, and on top of that, you're going to be able to actually put the money into the advertising as opposed to the talent, because that's essentially what you need to do early, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you got to have recognition. You know, it's the old saying that you can be giving away $100 bills, you don't tell anybody, you won't give any away.
Exactly.
You know, you got to get the word out there. Absolutely, absolutely. But then you get the word out. But you got to supply the product, and if somebody's just trying to, you know, the right people have to be in place. The right people have to be in place. One of the things that Eddie Einhorn had good wrestling talent back in the 70s when he tried to go national, but he had the wrong people calling the shots.
Yep. All right, so that's pretty much just about going to do it for us this week. Let's get some plugs.
So you're saying Johnny Powers isn't going to go into any Hall of Fame anytime soon?
I don't think so. Not really sure. Well, and Martinez, the Martinez kid was part of calling the shots too. Pedro's son out of Buffalo was part of it. What was Ronnie? Was that his name? I think he's just passed away. But anyway, yeah, no, I don't see it happening. Let me say that, of course, I'm going to be in Charlotte for the 5th through the 8th for Fan Fest. You can find out more about that NWALegends.com, and then the Rhode Island thing's been changed September the 25th. I'm going up there for Slam Tech. Bob Evans to do a seminar. And the 28th for Hazard, Kentucky at the Senate Community Center. That's August the 28th, HCW Wrestling on Facebook. For more information on that, I'm going to do some broadcasting there.
All right.
I'm playing Powerball. To try to be able to quit my job. I need an Eddie Einhorn of my own to just dump money into my pocket so I can quit my job and actually make it for that Charlotte convention, because this is just killing me. Besides that, you can catch me with Brian Alvarez at WrestlingObserver.com every Sunday from 6 to 8. Just go there or sportsbyline.com to find out the details on that. And, of course, the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare, which also because of work will not be featuring me much anytime soon. And you'll get Joe Gagne and Alan Cunahan, who do a very fine job themselves. Or don't listen at all and listen to Les and Doc.
There you go. And, of course, I want to remind everybody that tomorrow night, Peach State Pandemonium here on the GWH Radio Network at 8 o'clock with John Cannon, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
We will be back here next week with Colt Cabana will be our guest. And Lester, are you still going to be kind of spotty on being with us?
Yeah, well, I'm going to be away from the home front here for a month.
Right.
So, but I'll get with you and get as much airtime as I can.
Okay.
All
right. I mean, so Les may or may not be with us next week.
Well, I like listening to Colt. He's Santino that can work.
And of course, we do as the clock ticks down here. I want to thank Jim Ross and of course our listeners for joining us tonight. And of course, as always, Jen Holbrook and Sleepy Steve for their work behind the scenes. Check out JerryOatsNaturalProducts.com and YRGFitness.com and GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. That does it for us tonight. We will see you here next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.